Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Debate Night. First time ever introing the show. Normally this is what Hunter does, but we are here for a fun one. We got Trevor on board today. We got Silas behind the keys, and we are destined to not have a podcast that is delayed. That is the key. Silas?
That's the goal here today.
No delays.
Okay. I want to make a statement that I was not interrupting Hunter in the last podcast. There was some sort of delay situation between my audio and Hunter's, so it sounded like when we were recording, everything was good, but then when it actually went out to you guys, my audio was just like pushed up or something, and so I think we're good though. Trevor, no interruptions today, yeah?
None.
Minimal interruptions. I will say we did post on Twitter that you were coming on the show. A lot of people were excited about it because, surprisingly enough, I think some people think you and I would disagree on more topics than me and Hunter.
Not true at all.
But the thing is, I think all three of us kind of agree most of the time on like disc golf stuff, like big disc golf ideas. But Hunter, a lot of times, will, like, if debate night was not centered around disc golf, we would probably have so many debates because he says a lot of things that just make absolutely no sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why we have our most intense debates on the banter. That's kind of why that is the case.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I feel like usually when we have like a debate and it's like you, me, and Hunter, typically you and I side against Hunter.
A lot
in
of times,
most cases, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He now is like, you know, getting close to that professional golfer status, so he is coming to the dark side a little bit.
Yeah, that is true. He's felt the allure of the country club.
Yeah, he knows the country club lifestyle. But not too much went down this past week. I know you guys talked a little bit about Mid-America Open on Grip Locked.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously the big storyline, not really too much of a storyline there on FPO other than, you know, Sarah Hokum is the Silver Series queen when she's kind of the top player there. She does a good job of taking care of business, so shout out to her for that. I did find it was pretty funny when Luke Humphreys, who I thought actually did a pretty good job, we can talk about this too, about, I thought Luke Humphreys did a great job doing like the post interviews. I thought a lot of the questions he was asking were great.
Yeah.
The one that I thought was very funny was him asking, you know, hey, you know, you got kind of momentum going into Worlds. How's that feel? And she's like, yeah, I don't like those courses. I'm just going to show up.
Yeah.
But like basically said that she had no chance, which, which is honestly fair. I mean, those courses don't suit her game that well.
Yeah.
But with that being said, before we jump into the whole MPO side, which had the biggest story of the week, let's talk real quick. How do you think – I don't know if you watched live. I had a 12.5-hour drive, so I kind of had it playing while I was driving, which shout out to the lead card on MPO for making that round as long as possible. So my drive had something to watch. But how do you feel about the live interview – right afterwards, right, with Luke Humphreys.
Uh-huh.
And then they would do like a commercial break and they would come back and then Brian would do another interview with them.
Yeah.
They've been starting to do that more. What are your thoughts on that?
I've seen that before where it's like, okay, yeah, we'll go to a break and then we come back. We'll be like in the like post press conference area for – we'll hear more from them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. So I'm guessing what they're – mindset is, and this has probably always been the reason why they do the interviews the way they do, is because I think they feel like they're gonna miss some like moment if they don't talk to them immediately. And okay, so let's think, like, it's kind of like winning in disc golf has always kind of been awkward because, like, when you see the players, like, okay, let's think about this on the PGA Tour. What happens after a win? Okay. Usually some kind of exclamation from the player, maybe a fist pump, maybe a tip of the hat to the crowd, whatever. Then they're going to probably hug their caddy. Then they're going to shake the other player's hands. Then they're going to walk over and their family is going to greet them. Like, the crowd's going to be clapping the whole time. Like, it's kind of like a moment the camera captures it. Like, that's the moment you're looking for. In disc golf, a player taps out for the win, and they kind of just, like, stand there by the basket usually, and it's kind of just like they don't really know what to do with themselves.
Some of these courses are starting to set up in a way to where we could have a finish that looks good, because we are they're starting to set up like these scorers tents, and granted they are literally just like the tents that you would see like on the side of like a little kid's soccer game, so it's not like anything special, but they are starting to set up these scoring tents, and I think that's what we're missing, is like what you just said can all happen. Granted, the family's probably not there. But
Well, there's also not really caddies usually.
There's starting to be more on tour now.
Well, there's not really. Yeah, it's a little. The caddy relationship is a little different.
Yes,
though.
Definitely different. But you can still have kind of that interaction, and then you can still have the interaction of the player giving the high fives and stuff as they're walking to the scorer's tent. And then once they kind of get in the scorer's tent, that's when it's like, okay, let's not just like film them figuring out their scores. But yeah, you're right in the sense of where there is that awkwardness for a lot of the players when they win, of like they don't know where to go.
Yeah, they're just in no man's land, and I think maybe part of it has to do with like they know in their mind that an interview is about to come out of nowhere. So that might be part of it, because like I think they would normally just start walking away, but they kind of have to stand there. They almost feel like they're frozen on a, you know, they're stepping on a mine and they got to stand there and can't move. Now, and what I will say is, like, and the Pro Tour has always been, like, they never implement things 100%. They always, like, slowly implement things. And it's smart. It's very smart from their perspective, because they're working with – disc golf probably has the most, like, sporadic fan base of any sport, as far as people that are so on different pages as far as what they want in the sport. I mean, if you scroll through Reddit, like – people who hate live disc golf, people who love live disc golf, people who hate this, love that. Like, it's all over the place. So, like, I get their strategy. And I will say, particularly Terry and really all of them have gotten better at, like, okay, when we're doing this first interview, let's keep it very simple and like, very short as well. So it's getting better. And Terry is very good at, like, also, like, being – pretty prepared, I think, mm-hmm. for like when a player doesn't have anything to say, and like not just like standing there awkwardly
with the microphone,
so,
like
right. Yeah, so I don't know if like their goal is like, okay, we're moving in the direction of getting rid of that, so let's just slowly phase it out, or if they've just kind of settled in on a new strategy that they're trying. I still think it's a bit strange. I think it's even more strange that you hand them the trophy right away. And like, I've never been a big fan of, like, I never really liked the TD walking out there and, like, right after they win going, like, looking at them and saying, like, here he is, like, you're blah, blah, blah champion. Like,
that's
that always
weird,
looks weird to me.
It's a very weird one.
It just looks strange. Like, I'd rather, like.
Some sort of award ceremony.
Right. Just, like, and it can literally
be. It doesn't even have to be that big.
No. Like, literally just, like, take your time, walk out there, give it, like, 10 minutes or so, 5-10 minutes, and then like have everybody gather around, mm-hmm. maybe like bring in the gallery tighter so it closes that space a little bit, and then like do a proper ceremony, like we'd like to, on the behalf of blah blah blah, we'd like to congratulate the winner, like, and it's just something that takes rehearsal. I think like once the problem is too, like the whole live broadcast is such a like figure it out situation. Like, you don't have, there's probably nobody working on the Disc Golf Network with a experience in like live television, because like in live television, everything they're doing is so meticulously directed to make it look like a movie. Mm. Like, you're watching, right. You're watching golf events and like, oh, and then they bring in the B-roll shot of them engraving a name on the trophy. And then they like every shot is very planned to make it look cinematic. And disc golf just, it's still, there's still parts of the broadcast that feel like a home video. Mm-hmm. And I think the winner's circle is really a big part, because it's like, okay, we're switched to a camera that's still walking up to them. And Terry is just kind of standing there awkwardly waiting for his signal. Like, all of that is probably the biggest part of the broadcast that isn't polished.
They don't
yet.
Have,
so I think they're just still working.
Yeah,
on
they
it.
Don't have one thing that they, I think they're missing is like they don't have like a package ready to go. Now obviously they have like the highlights at the end, like, you know, they're like, yeah, oh, yeah, earlier. But they don't have like some sort of like package of like, this is what you guys just witnessed to kind of cut to, exactly, or something. But one thing I think they're also missing, I'd be curious to see what you think of this, is I think as the Pro Tour continues to grow, as they continue to get more and more fans, I think it's going to be very important that they are not just focusing on, and they're doing this obviously by having another camera out on the course, being able to film people that are, you know, playing well or moving up the leaderboards that aren't necessarily on like the two live cards. But
it's
going to be very important for them to continue to build names, to continue to get more and more pros coverage, however they can, to get more people. Like, because if you, the way I look at it too, is there's a reason why some of these like boy bands or girl bands have been so popular. And it's because, like, I'll go back to my early days, like NSYNC, for example, that was like the big one, with obviously Backstreet Boys, 98, all of them. But like, when you have a group of people, you really only need one person to like connect to someone of that group. And if you get one person out of the four or five you have, like, that person now is a fan of that group because of that one person. Versus like if you have like a solo artist. Now, granted, obviously solo artists are probably like the Justin Biebers, the Michael Jacksons, the Beyoncés. Like, they are going to probably be just as big, if not bigger, than the groups. But I just think groups can, like, they do well because each person can kind of reach a different audience. And I think that kind of crazy analogy I just did.
Yeah, like, take me home.
That one could go also into disc golf, of where if you're only seeing these six players and none of them are really like reaching you for whatever reason, you might be missing out on like a Chandler Kramer that reaches a different audience, an Isaac Robinson that reaches a different, now obviously Isaac won it, but you know what I'm saying? Like, people that, there might be a lot of people that love to see Isaac and we don't ever get to see him or hear from him unless he is in the top eight at a tournament. Yeah. And so one thing I think they could do, and I played with Luke Humphreys yesterday, and since he was doing the interviews afterwards, I was saying one thing that I would love to see is, it doesn't take that much equipment, I don't think. I mean, you could almost technically do it with like a cell phone, or this is where they need to figure out a way of being able to film stuff without like the live box and get people the footage. Because I would love to see someone that, let's say second round, right? They shot even par. They're eight shots off the lead. But second round, they went out and shot 10 under. So like, starting of the day, they're in the top 10 before live has even started, right?
Yeah.
I would love to have an interview with that person that they could cut to at some point. And they're like, earlier today, freaking Paul Ulibarri shot 10 under. Incredible round. Let's hear from what he has to say. Like, I think they have a good – that's one thing. Like, you only get interviews from, like, the people that are leading. And then occasionally you might get an interview for someone that, like, had a really good round, is now in the lead. But I would love to see – like, they could easily throw in – like, when they have segments of, like, not knowing what to do, that would be a perfect time to have, like, a 15, 20-second interview with – 10 different players throughout the day.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they do that. They do that on the PGA Tour. Like, get guys after they finish up on 18, and they'll flash to them, like, as the leaders are still playing.
It's a quick little one. It's like,
They're starting to like have a more variety. One of the shots that they had,
they need to stop using drone shots too for actual shots.
Ooh, I disagree.
For certain putts? For putts?
No, not for putts. They're the only. Okay, the only. Let me be clear on my stance on this. The only shots that I have seen with, I've seen a lot of bad drone shots, but the only ones I've seen that I thought were cool were up shots. There were certain up shots that were like wide open, so like you don't need to see a line.
And but you watching can see the how disc, close the disc gets to the basket.
Right. And also, it just gives you a good perspective of the distance of the shot. And let me also be clear.
Is it too high, though? Would you like the drone if it was sitting like 50 feet above the ground, not 150?
It's like, okay, you know, it's like when you're watching the NBA and they switch to an alternate camera angle for like one possession. This is what I'm talking about. Like doing that drone shot every once in a while, just for like, oh, that's a cool shot. Like I saw seeing the disc. Yeah, like seeing the disc fly from that angle. Like you don't usually see that. I was like, that was really cool. Obviously, it's a dangerous slippery slope because if like people say they like it, you know, sometimes the pro tour can be like, oh shoot, and then just start like spamming it, and like
drone
that has happened.
Only footage.
Yeah, and like that is not like the pro tour does need to understand that at the end of the day, when I'm watching a throw, I always want to see it from behind the player.
They cut to catch cam really quick.
Oh
a lot
my
of times.
Gosh, they do it so badly sometimes, and like when I
wonder though if that is, and I'm not trying to throw people under the bus, but I have a hard time believing. This is why, but like maybe the people behind aren't following the disc nearly as good.
I don't know. I think sometimes they just cut for the sake of cutting to like they think they're adding flair to the broadcast.
You just lose all idea of the shape of the
this
shot.
Even happens. This happens at every level. Like this happens in when I'm watching the PGA Tour. Sometimes they'll cut to a putting angle that I just don't like. And I'm like, why did you do that? So it happens a lot. But in disc golf, like, if all else fails, if you stay behind the player, like, that's always going to be the better angle. My least favorite is when they go with the face on while a player is throwing. And they decide to make that the angle. And I can't see where the disc goes out of their hand. I'm like, that is the angle that you use for instant replay when we want to see how the player reacted to a shot. And that is the only time. There is literally no reason to watch a player throw from face on and then not follow the disc. It's one thing if they're way up there on the tee and we're watching the throw come towards the camera. That's whatever.
That's also a cool angle.
That's a good angle, yeah. But when I'm zoomed in tight on Paige Pierce and she throws and I don't see where the disc ends up, until it cuts there, and I have no idea what just happened. Like, that makes me so mad. I'm like, why would you do that? And the best part is when that throw – so they'll start in face on the player. Mm-hmm. They'll throw. It'll go, like, 3 seconds, and then they'll cut to behind the player. So you're telling me there was a camera there the whole
that's
time.
That's the worst, is you show that there actually was a camera. Yeah.
Right. That's how you know they were just doing it for the sake of doing it. I'm like, just please don't. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Got to see the disc fly.
It is sometimes frustrating because it's like sometimes like just the simple things is more ideal a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think maybe even that's why sometimes people like Jomez more than live, because like Jomez has the ability of taking the time. You know, they have all the footage, so they have taking the time of like, all right, we're going to – and there's almost like a formula at this point, right, of where it's like,
oh, for sure,
we'll do this, and we cut to this, and then we cut back to this and insert this. Yeah. So, but, yeah, it's definitely – live coverage is definitely getting better, I would say, obviously. It's only going to continue to get better. But I'm with you on, like, there are certain things with, like, the interview. I just have the interview thing wrapping it all back up to the interview. I thought it was interesting that they were like, they had to get the interview right afterwards. And then they are like, well, we always get an interview with the booth as well.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like they're trying to do the whole interview. Let's hear what they have to say, like right after the moment. And then what we're missing is like the setup of the awards stage, and we're missing all that to where then they bring everyone out. And then at that point too, those interviews really are more like directed to the person, like thanking his family, thanking the crowd. Like a lot of times at either a PGA event, an NBA finals, a Super Bowl, whenever they do, you know, cause you get the quick interview right afterwards. And then you get the interviews later when, you know, you get Mike Tirico out of the booth coming down there. And a lot of that's more like directed to like the people right there kind of thing. So it's like definitely a different vibe. But I just thought these two interviews were very similar. And so, you know, something that they're obviously testing and working, and hopefully they can get kind of dialed up. So without that, let's switch over to the big story on the MPO side of Mid-America, where you had lead card. And I was playing with Gannon yesterday, and I saw Alden as well. And I think it's too close to get like more details. Like I congratulated Gannon on the second place and congratulated Alden on winning. And I didn't want to be like, oh, by the way, like what happened? Why did you guys, why were you guys playing so slow? Like, I didn't want to ask that just yet. I will get around to it to kind of get an idea of like, because sometimes when you have cameras on you, granted Chase Card also had cameras on them, but sometimes when you have cameras on you, it can be slow. Like sometimes the cameras aren't in position, so you're waiting. Also, when you're on those cards, you're going to have spectators. Sometimes you get in, and I don't think that was the issue. It didn't really look like I wasn't there. Didn't really look like that many people showed up. So it didn't seem like they were having crowd issues of where like every hole they're like, we had to tell people to move. So I don't know exactly. I don't want to just throw someone under the bus and be like, this person just played super slow. I did see that Gannon obviously had multiple shots that took a long time. I believe Alden did as well. I don't know about the other two guys. Connor and Evan were playing poorly at the beginning, and on a course like that, that can rack up a lot of time real quick. We've all played, you know, wooded courses with people that are having bad days, and it doesn't move that fast. But this goes back to my whole discussion on this of where I don't think the answer is like a shot clock for, I don't think having like a 30 second, like, hey, you need to throw a shot in 30 seconds. I don't think that is the answer. I actually hate that idea.
Yeah, I do too.
Because there are some, like, I don't want people to get in spots that they feel rushed and they feel like they have to make a quick decision because they only have 30 seconds. Like, certain times you have to take your time, figure out, like, I've never been over here. I can barely get to my disc. Let me try to figure out a line. What am I trying to do? Assess the risk and then execute your shot. The thing that needs to be quicker is, like, putting. You have a straightforward 25-footer. That shouldn't take that long. A straightforward 200-foot upshot, that shouldn't take that long. And tee shots. Like, the tee shot doesn't change. Granted, maybe wind might come into play sometimes, but tee shots should not take that long either. And with all those things taken into account, it then needs to be kind of like a group. And this happened to us at D-Glow. We had a PGA marshal come up to us and say, hey, there's a two-hole gap between you and the group in front of you. You guys need to, and we had like the last two holes, we had two discs that we almost lost. So we were just like looking for discs for 3 minutes, and that's how you kind of can get a big gap like that. And so we looked at everyone. We're like, all right, let's play quick. And within two holes, we caught right back up with them. So, it can happen that way. And I think that's the right way of going about it is like, if a PDJ marshal was there or the TD or someone was there, like when that five hole gap got created, or I don't even think you let it get that far. Maybe two holes. It get two holes.
Oh, yeah.
And you come to them and say, you guys have a two hole gap. You guys need to get this closer. And if they don't, then you give them a warning, and then you can start assessing strokes. And you start assessing strokes on people that are taking too long. That's the key.
Yeah. The whole shot clock thing, people. It's such a tough thing. Like, whenever you're dealing with golf, like, it's so hard to understand, like, that there's, like, unwritten rules and, like, etiquette that, like, pushes the game forward. Like, it's not everything. Like, the game just can only exist in its purest form if people just agree to follow the rules without having to, like, have a mini with a shot clock in it. Like, the idea that, like, if you, like, everybody thinks, like, oh, it's so simple. Like, just have everybody is timed with 30 seconds. Okay, well, now imagine a scenario where Gannon Burr, or whoever it is putting out for the win on 18, and, oh, he's 1 second too late, and now he loses. How stupid is that, right? Like, that would be, like, his mini starts buzzing. Oh, no, he didn't beat the buzzer, and it would be the dumbest thing ever. So, like, it's so easy to say, oh, let's just add in a time limit. But the way this is supposed to work is that, you know, you normally are supposed to just take not a lot of time to play, and then you're going to have some shots during the round that take a little bit more time, and then it should balance itself out. And I agree. I think that a marshal should just be in play. There needs to be marshals in play on every event that can be called over if need be to speed things up and say, hey, let's get things going. And I think if enough warnings come into play, like I would say, okay, let's say you have a group of four that's playing really slow. There's a two-hole gap. You come up to them and you say, hey, can you guys speed it up? Another two holes go by, and now there's a three-hole gap. Then I think maybe you come over and say, hey, this marshal's going to stay with this group and be keeping an eye on time. Maybe that's what we get to, like, okay, he's going to now be hand-timing mm-hmm. for a little bit. But I certainly don't like the idea of everybody having a no. timer on them, because now all of a sudden we're playing a different sport. Because that creates – now there's this whole nother skill in disc golf, which is how quickly can you assess your lie and get a throw yeah. off. It's like – now it's like it changes the entire sport essentially. It would just look so gimmicky. It's shocking how long it takes some people.
I would
to
argue,
shots.
Though,
really
Trevor,
is.
I would argue that the obviously yes, when you see someone taking a minute to throw a shot, you're gonna notice that. I would argue though, there are a lot of things that players can do that aren't filmed to speed up play. So like in between shots, there are people that dilly dally, to where that could save 30 seconds on the hole. There are players that continue to like just stand behind the person throwing and watching their. And yes, obviously we're supposed to watch everyone's shot. I got it, but you don't have to watch their shot from right behind them or 30 feet from behind them.
No, you could go to your.
So
lie,
there's
yeah.
that kind of thing of where it's just like, okay, we all stand here, watch your shot. We all stand here, we watch your shot. We all stand here, and like that right there takes a long time. Putting yeah. is another one of where instead of doing like you're furthest out, then you're furthest out, and you're having people basically walk across, and then they are walking, and everyone's having to move around because no one wants to stand behind the basket. There's ways of doing. There's ways of speeding up the game. Of where it's like just tapping out. Tapping out is another huge thing that speeds up the game. Like if you have a 25 footer and you miss, it is going to be way faster for you just to go up. Even if you miss to 10 feet, it's going to be way faster for you to go up and finish and then get out of the way and be done than for you then to get out of the way, someone else get back in the way, and then you're eventually have to get back in the way. So like small things like that.
Right.
And the last kicker I would say that takes a long time when you add it up across 18 holes is the scorekeeping of where if you have someone doing score that is like someone's caddy and they just forgot that they're keeping score on hole three and you have someone on the card that wants to be like, because it's different. I've played where we all basically keep our own scores and we obviously have an idea of what everyone shot and we have multiple scorekeepers already. So it's kind of one of those things of where it's like, we'll figure it all out at the end. If there's anyone that, you know, if this person and this person have differing ideas of what they shot, then we can go back and figure it out. We don't necessarily need to have like a, okay, what did everyone get? But if you have someone on the card that wants to be like, all right, like some volunteer, some UDUS volunteer is like, all right, Trevor, you're like four. All right, Bill, three. Johnny. Like, when you start doing that, like, that's 30 seconds a hole.
Yeah.
And that, you know, over the course, that's 10 minutes. And it might not seem like a lot, but that adds up. And then on top of that, what ends up happening is a lot of times if you're on a card that is constantly waiting on the card in front of you and you're just constantly waiting, what do you do? Do you continue to play fast? Or do you say, guys, we're going to be waiting all day. We might as well just take our time. And then what does that do for the people behind you? Up. So it's like this weird like thing of where it just, as it gets worse, it just gets continued worse throughout the day. So something to think about. I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus. and say it was this person's fault or that person's fault. I did think it was funny that Drew posted that tweet saying, like, all the activities that he did prior to them getting onto the 18th hole. Yeah. That was pretty funny. But yeah, pace of play, it's going to get more and more of an issue as live coverage gets more and more popular, because you're going to get a worse product. It's just a worse product having to wait.
Yeah, that was the frustrating thing, is seeing people that were cutting on the live coverage because of pace of play, and it just doesn't need to happen. Because, like, you know, with the card ahead of them getting finished so quickly, there was way too many holes where there was no other golf to fill in with other than the leaders. Mm-hmm. And then you've got two guys on that card of the leaders who are not even in it, so they're not even needing to show all of their shots either. So, like, it just got – it got messy. I think the thing is, too, like, a lot of these players that are, like, the offenders, essentially, of this issue, the problem is – they're not realizing what they're doing. Like, I think they're just too far in their head that, like, they don't have a concept of how much time is going by while they're rehearsing or doing their routine, because they're just completely, like, zoned out. So I think that's the hardest thing, is, like, they're just gonna have to basically develop quicker routines. But I agree, there's also a lot of other things that can be done to speed things up, and it's just gonna
be I feel like I'm a pretty fast player when you look at the average.
Yeah.
And I was getting messages after DDO saying how long I was taking on some of my shots. And I was like, what? Was I taking that long? And
no,
to be fair, though, like, some of the shots in DDO, I think I was taking definitely over 30 seconds. But when I was playing, it's exactly what you're saying. Like, when I was playing, it didn't feel like, oh, man, I've been standing over deliberating on what to do for way too long. Like,
no.
Time slows down so much when you're, like, in that focus mode.
Yeah.
That doesn't feel like I've been waiting for a minute to throw the shot. So
the only time I've ever felt like, oh, I'm taking up too much time, is, like, if I switch discs, like, twice. Like, if I'm like, oh, I want this shot, and I switch once, and then I have to switch a second time to another disc, then I feel like, okay, this shot's taking a while. But until that point, like, I think it's tough, too, because in disc golf, there are so many disc golf players who are step-up-and-throw guys that there can be a huge, stark difference between those guys and even guys that take a normal, acceptable amount of time. So if you take even a little bit extra, people are like, oh, my goodness, I've been here for
eternity. There's definitely more of a vibe of, like, in rhythm, like in a basketball shot, of just, like, guys that just want to be in rhythm, and they don't have, like, a pre-shot routine of where – They literally, as they walk on the tee pad, they're going. And so you're right. It does make a stark difference. That gives me an idea, though, for a future video for you and Hunter, where you probably would only be able to do it for, like, three or four holes. But do, like, go to, like, New London, like, a longer course. You can go, like, Fallen Creek Golds. And you basically have to address your shot, but you can't throw or putt for a minute. So you get to your mini that's like 25 feet, and you get there and you're setting up. You have to set up like you're going to putt, and then the other person, Hunter, or, you know, if Hunter's up, the other person's got a stopwatch, and you start the stopwatch, and you have to sit there for a minute, and then just
I think
that would be a hard challenge
for putting, for throwing it. I don't think it would bother
me. You don't think
me.
Sitting like Maybe standing like a, on hole one at New London for a minute, just looking at that shot, not affected?
Not really. Not dramatically enough to, like, feel the
putting,
effect,
though.
I don't think.
Maybe you just do it.
But
maybe just do it
putting
for
putting,
for
sure.
Just only for putting.
If you had to stand over a putt for a super long time every single time, and you weren't allowed to back off it, that would be tough. I don't know. Yeah, that would be
like you miss a 30-footer and it rolls to like another 30-footer, and then you have to walk over there and stand there for another minute.
The only problem is it would be tough to gauge correctly, only because, like, if it's just like a normal video, like, the pressure isn't super elevated. Like, if we had to do that in, like,
that is
like
true.
A
maybe it's a punishment then. Maybe it's
a
punishment that
match.
Like, in the next weekly you have to
do it. Oh man, I'd hate whoever.
Yeah, and hopefully
to play
you don't get punched
weekly
by someone.
Yeah. No, because, like, yeah, if there was enhanced pressure, that's when it would really
come
into play.
Have we ever discussed my favorite punishment that you will never do, that you have decided eventually will crack you and it'll be a punishment? But have we ever discussed the – I don't think – Saz, we haven't discussed it on this podcast.
What is it?
It's the one where the loser has to show up to, like, the local mini as if, like, they're – and it's not, like – it's not like in Lynchburg. It's like in a different, because you guys already do enough stuff there that people kind of have an idea of who you are. So it wouldn't work. You'd have to be like, it would have to be in a different spot. So it's like, you go
to Tampa. Like, not everybody would know us. Or
Tampa.
Whatever.
You go to like a local mini in Tampa and you show up like you're the top dog. And you're like walking up to people, grabbing the phone, grabbing their phones out of their hands, taking selfies. Walking up to people
stabbed.
Like, oh, you want me to sign that disc?
Like,
you really haven't even time to respond. You just grab their disc and sign it. Like that. That's the
best punishment of all time. That would be only. That would be very funny if like I was mic'd.
Well, yeah,
up,
it's
so
like a hidden camera.
Like,
you're gonna have a wire on you, and we're gonna have a hidden camera on you.
What's funny about that is like there are just some people on the disc golf course that you meet that are just like blatantly arrogant and like are not self-aware about it. Like I can't tell you how many times I've talked to somebody, like somebody will come up to me and be like, I mean, there was this guy in Charleston who literally came up to me and told me that he was kind of a local legend in the area, and he said it with a straight face. Like I just don't understand. Like, and like there are people who be like, he'll just be like, yeah, man, like, yeah, I've shot, like, 4 course records at this course. Like, yeah, like there are just so many people who, like, just say things like that and don't realize how it's perceived. And, like, I'm okay to let it slide because I just understand that that's a personality type that exists and, like, whatever. But, like, most people are going to look at them and be like, are you kidding me right now? Like, why are you bragging to me? Like, it's insane.
Or if you're playing like a hole, they'll tell you about like the best time, like the best
and
time
like
you've
if
ever
you
played.
Have like a
be like, dude, I
yeah,
parked
like
this
it's,
hole. I parked this hole.
Yeah,
last,
dude.
Yesterday,
dude, aced this
like,
hole
oh,
twice
sick,
in a
man.
Row. Like, okay, I doubt it, but that's what I'm saying. Like, I would do that punishment, and I would just look like a normal, like a disc golfer that shows up a lot. Like, I don't even know if I'd be like the most cocky one there. There'd be like another guy who's just out doing it.
It still would just be funny to see you and Hunter have to. I think Hunter honestly would pull it off better than you. I think you would have a harder time.
Just for the embarrassment factor?
Like keeping, keeping a straight face and like being able to do it. I think you would have a harder time.
I don't know.
I think Hunter can get to like those. I think Hunter sometimes can get into like that mode of where he just like blocks everything off and is just oblivious to everything. And then he can get out of it. I think you would have a hard time like signing some kid's baby and having to walk away and not like be like, oh my gosh, I got to get out of here.
I don't know. I mean, I think if I were able to convince myself to get into that mode and not care, then I could definitely stay in it. But I don't know if I could go that far down that path.
Yeah, it would start escalating really quick.
I would definitely get yelled at. I wish so badly that I could be that guy who could just like insert myself into situations like that and just like act like a crazy person and get really good content out of it. But it's so hard. It's so difficult to do that.
I was there for like a couple years of my life.
Yeah.
I had that stretch of where I was doing like these videos where it was just like
super sporadic.
Now that I look back on it, I'm like, how the heck did I ever do? Like, I would feel so uncomfortable doing those now. But yeah, it's just you get into the mode of where it's just like, I'm just going to do
it.
Well,
once you get into it and like you get through a few people, it's a lot easier. But like, oh, it's tough.
The start is definitely the hardest. I will say I do go through a lot of like the autograph, how like the autograph lines work right now. That's a different story. But I actually will like, instead of like, because I hate sitting at a table and having people come up to me one by one. I think that's just very weird. So I'll actually like go down the line instead. It's much faster. And then also it helps to where like if you want, let's say, my autograph and you want someone else's autograph that's not there, you don't have to, like, get my autograph and then go to the back of the line to wait for the next person to come. You kind of just stay in your line as I go down. But with doing that, I make it very apparent to, like, hey, if you don't want my signature, that it, like, definitely let me know. Like, don't, because it's very awkward for not necessarily for me really, but it's way more awkward for someone else that, like, doesn't want my signature. And, like, I come up and I'm like, you want me to sign that? And they're like, yeah. And then you sign it and you walk away and they're like, gosh dang. And it's like, I don't want that. That's happened that's before. I do not want that to happen. Yeah, I do not want that to happen of where I sign someone's disc. So I'm just always like, hey, if you don't, like, do you want me to sign that or not? Like, or I'll do like a, I'll like, when it gets to like towards the end, and it kind of just seems like people are just whatever. I'm like, does anyone else want autographs? And like people will be like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then that way I'm not in that situation of where I'm just assuming everyone wants my autograph. And then you sign someone. They're
it's
like,
the worst.
They're like, oh, dude,
like, yeah, you can sign it, I guess. Like, sure.
Yeah. Oh, I don't want to put people in that situation because that's such an awkward situation to be in. All right. Do you have anything else? Like, I have some other stuff that we can talk about, but do you have anything, like, relevant, I guess you could say, like, to kind of like the time right now? I mean, we can talk about. I guess we can talk about a little bit. We normally go into the tournament coming up, so we can talk a little bit about Ledgestone.
Yeah, no, I think I think we should. I think we can talk about Ledgestone. Well, I saw that you tweeted about Northwoods.
Yeah, it's a top three wooded course.
I think
New London, Northwoods. I haven't decided which, like, what order, but New London, Northwoods, and W.R. Jackson.
Okay.
I think are my top three wooded courses.
Makes sense.
I haven't played Maple Hill, which I think is wooded.
A lot of it is wooded.
And is it Fox Run or is it the other one at GMC is wooded? I feel like there's one wooded course
Smuggler's
out there
Notch.
That people love. Is it Smugglers?
I think Smugglers.
There's a course out there that I think is kind of wooded that people really like.
Yeah,
as
there
well.
Is one that's pretty popular out there.
I haven't played those, so I'm not obviously I can't put those into that list, but I have to say, challenging, very challenging course. You've got some holes that, you know, require, like the par fours, you have some holes that are like placement. And if you don't get in the right place off the tee, like short placement too, like I'm talking like sub 300 placement, sub 300 second shot placement.
Yeah.
That can be very tricky. That's cool. And then you got those mixed in with, like, you got to throw 400 feet. You got to throw another 400 feet. I like that. I didn't get through a single hole that felt like I've already played this hole before.
Okay.
Or felt like was unfair.
Yeah.
And to me, that, like, it's got scoring separation. You can bogey every single hole out there. You can birdie every single hole out there. It's a really good course.
I mean, if every course that I've ever played that, like, is wooded and is a good course is, like, yeah, if you can play every single hole and every single one of them, you feel like you can't get cheated. And I would say for me, like, just because there is a 5-foot fairway, like 300 feet down the line, that's still not really fair to me.
Correct.
Like, I'm talking about
the fairways are good. Yeah, the fairways are good. Good width.
Yeah,
they're not too short.
Because, like, I don't mind, like, heavy punishment if you miss the fairway. Like, as long as there's an opportunity that if you throw a good shot, you are going to have a good result. That's really all a wooded course needs.
And I think this one does a good job, and I think this might be the future of woods golf. I haven't really thought about that until this point of where. You have no trees in the fairway at all for the first shot, for your tee shot on like par fours or par five. No trees. But your second shot, you have tons of trees.
Okay.
And I like that a lot because you don't get punished off the tee shot for throwing a good shot. But someone that doesn't throw a good shot off the tee shot, their second shot now is extremely difficult because now they have to not only scramble out of whatever rough they're in, but they also don't have a clear shot to the basket.
Yeah.
Where now someone that throws a perfect shot, tee shot, they also don't have like the automatic birdie of like, oh, you just threw a perfect tee shot, 250-foot upshot, nothing your way, here's your birdie. So I thought this course does a really good job of not that much like I mean, obviously there are very, very tight shots off the tee pad. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you're not going to get punished by throwing down the fairway and having it nick a tree in the fairway and go into the rough. So that was kind of cool to see. And then Eureka on the flip side is just a really fun course. Yeah. I think you would really like playing both these courses. You guys should come out here one year.
Yeah,
this is a good tournament to come out to.
Yeah, I think we definitely will. I would love to play Eureka. I mean, Northwoods, it just kind of has a reputation. I agree. I'd much rather see players have the difficult shot come second shot, because I think watching people hit first available off the tee pad is just like depressing. Like, it's not fun to watch. Like, I don't mind somebody trying to scramble and hitting an early tree, but off the tee, it's like, you know, I want to see tee shots get out there. I'd rather see a tee shot turn errant as it gets down the fairway rather than
10 feet,
like,
off the
10 feet off the fairway. So
like a quick gap.
Yeah. So I like that. Yeah, there's nothing I hate worse than like a gap that is like so close to the tee pad that you can practically touch it with your hand from your throw. I can't stand that. There is like this obsession in disc golf to like, oh my gosh, look at these trees that are like 4 feet apart. What if we had the end of the tee pad just end right in the middle of this gap? Or like why do they do that? I don't understand. I see it all the time, and it's,
yeah, I think you're right in the sense of like it definitely can be a fun hole to play, but does it have the best look?
Yeah, no, I think it looks
in a product.
Yeah,
it's like you said, it's tough when, because if all four players throw through it, then you basically are like, oh, that's not hard at all.
Yeah,
but if one person misses, the problem with that is now you have someone that literally just threw 4 feet off the tee, and now it's like an awkward situation.
That's
an interesting one. I haven't really thought about that. Like how far away should like the first gap be that you need to hit?
Yeah, I like if I'm fine with like a consistent fairway length, like all the way back to the tee. I just don't like when it's like, I remember they did it at the Portland Open like 2 years ago when they first went to the golf course, and there was a few tees where it was like, okay, there's no defense for this hole because we're throwing it into a golf fairway. So let's just put the tee pad pointing at this tiny little gap. And then like nobody hit any of those trees the whole event. So it just kind of looked stupid. Like now you're just blocking the view of the throw.
That makes sense too, yeah.
And like, I mean, there's one hole at WR Jackson. I think it's 17? The one that has a tiny gap. So you have to go up the hill and then it kind of turns right. Very tough par four.
Yeah, 17's very tight gap off the tee.
It has that little gap, and like, and maybe this is just like from the experience of playing it in college, but I think it just created weird scenarios where like only one person would miss the gap, and then like it's almost like too severe of a punishment. It's kind of like that miss big, miss small argument where it's like if you're missing big, a lot of times you get luckier than the people that miss small.
That is true.
And so when you have gaps like that, you'll see people who miss big and they either hit the tree square and land right in front of it, or they'll miss big and miss it completely and go like around it.
Go way far down, yep.
And then you'll have people that miss small and just get kicked to oblivion right off the front of the tee box. And now they're punished so drastically for that. Like, I think the whole miss big, miss small thing can only be fine-tuned so much. So I think you should try to avoid – like
I came up with a solution one episode. It's billboards.
What? What is
so,
that mean?
So, tree billboards. So you essentially like, okay, if you have a gap – with, you know, here,
yeah,
and you're like, I don't want people to like be able to miss the gap and still go up. You put billboards with signs and sell that space, and so people are just drilling the billboards.
Well, it's basically like it's basically what the Zuka cart thing is that people throw through.
Yeah, yeah, that big huge huge thing. Yeah, exactly.
It's basically that.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can also do it
in trees.
You could just make it a double Mando, you know.
Yeah, that is the other thing you could do.
But, I mean, billboards are cool, too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can sell space, ad space.
It's all about ad space.
I do think, though, going back to Eureka, I do think that course, you guys would both love it because it has some really good shots of where the risk is there and the reward is there, and it's not just like on one or two holes. Well, like all these holes are iconic.
Hunter has
like,
played Ledgestone.
Yeah, he's played it.
Yeah,
he was. This is where I initially kicked him off my bag. This was the first spot. I did it at Idlewild as well, but this was the first location.
Yeah,
I lost my Thrasher in the practice field, and I couldn't recover.
A good time.
Couldn't recover. I will say, since I haven't played Eureka in 2 years, it is a lot easier now far as the shots I'm able. Like, I remember, I'm trying to think of what hole it is. I think it's 8. It's right before the bridge par 3. So
there was a forehand that you were struggling with big time last time around.
Every forehand. My forehand was so bad.
I just remember there was one where you just had to like get off the tee with just like a hyzer forehand, and you could not throw it at all.
Yeah, the forehand was so bad. But this hole I'm talking, I think it's 8. It's right before the bridge hole where you throw the par 3 off the bridge.
Yeah.
It's got like a 30-foot gap, maybe 200 feet off the fairway of where it's just like a bunch of trees and bushes to the left, a bunch of trees and bushes to the right. And you're throwing like an open field, and then you gotta get through this little gap into another open field. And walking up to it, Gannon's like, "Oh, you're probably doing the hyzer route." I was like, "What?" He's like, "You're probably doing the hyzer route." And I remember I played with Aiden Gerthy, who, for those that don't know, this guy throws so far. And he did this when I played with him. I was like, "My gosh, who would ever do that?" And now, like, when you get to the point of like, as you increase your distance, like you start looking for shots that you would not have in the past. Like,
most definitely.
Yeah. If you can only throw 400 feet, you're not looking at potentially, can I get over these trees that are 300 feet away and 60 feet high? Like, you're like, you already do the math. Like, no, but I'm probably just going to throw like a high, if the wind's right, the wind was a tailwind, so it was good wind, I'll probably just throw like a hyzer all over these trees and like take the gap out completely. So like, there's certain shots like that that obviously make the course a lot easier. But again, it's one of those courses where if you're throwing good, you're throwing it in bounds, you're going to score well. And if you have an off day, or you're not putting well, you can easily shoot over par out there. So it's still a good course, I think, in my opinion. And if the wind is up, then that course gets obviously drastically more difficult.
Oh, yeah, it gets way tougher.
But I think this is going to be an overall pretty fun tournament. I think there's going to be a decent amount of people, a good crowd, which is always awesome.
It should be packed just because the size of the AM field.
2,000 people playing.
Yeah, there's so many people at that event. I don't like. Think about the amount of money they're bringing in. It's crazy. It's the largest tournament in the world at this point. So.
I think you have to still do that though. I think for a lot of these places, you have to have some sort of like events and stuff going on to attract the people to come out. And then now that they're already coming out, they might as well watch. Because I don't think you're going to have like the person from Chicago that's like 2 hours away. I don't know if that person, if they weren't playing in the tournament, I don't know if they're making the 2 hour drive to come watch. So that is an interesting point. Interesting strat. All right. I got nothing less left in the short term. We got a couple of topics. I'm gonna run through these real quick, honestly, because I think some of these are kind of But first one, these are some of the debates that me and actually Hunter debated. I had Silas pull these from the archives. So these are the handful of things that me and Hunter have actually debated on debate
night.
We'll
see if we actually disagree about any of them.
All right, so the first one is duration of Worlds. Do you think Worlds, for it to be like, do you think it needs to be 7 days, 7 rounds, 6 rounds, 5? Do you think it needs to be more rounds than 4, essentially?
So I'm super – this argument, I've gone back and forth on this one because it kind of drives me nuts, because this is where I'm at with Worlds is I don't – my soul does not like the idea of a golf event being more than 4 rounds. I do not like it whatsoever. I think it's stupid. And I think, like, final nines are dumb. Like, I just don't like
it. We both agree there.
I like the idea of like changing up a format in the middle. Like, I don't know. It's weird. I don't like it. What I'll add to that is I think that the idea behind the extra rounds originally was probably to make sure that the best player won. And back in the day, there was very clearly best players. And that's the reason why you had Paul winning so many worlds, Climo winning so many worlds. They were clearly the best player. That's why that you gave them that many rounds, they're going to win. These days, there really isn't clearly a best player. There is like so many guys that even if you gave them eight rounds, it's going to change a lot who wins. Mm-hmm. Like there's so many good players now. So I think to that point, I think that point is null and void at this stage. So the other thing I'll add, the reason why I'm torn with this argument is the whole world title thing is weird. The idea that we have a world championships and there's nothing, and other sports do this, like other niche sports just like have a world title just because it's fun to have and it draws a crowd. But why do we have a world championship? Like, what does that actually mean? I understand why disc golf started it back in the day, because they're like, hey, let's bring everybody together from the sport all together for one big event and have the world championship. Mm-hmm. Because back then there wasn't a tour.
Everyone comes out of the woodwork.
Right. Let's get everybody together, world championship. Well, nowadays, that's not the case. Now we have a tour. So when the world championship happens, it's fine that it's a major event, but like we're assigning this value to the title of world champion that really isn't deserved, because that event, you know, it can carry like majors. I think we all agree that like the whole reason majors are so tough to win is because there's that extra history, that extra pressure, and the field is always going to be at its strongest. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. Like, it's fine to have an event that's special for those reasons, but calling it a world title when there's nothing else different about it is odd. So like, I think I've convinced myself, like, it's so like, having a world champion is such a part of the tradition of disc golf that it's really tough to like just get rid of it. But I'm at the point now where like I think that if there's still going to be a world championship, it should probably be extra rounds to make it different, or it should happen maybe biannually or every 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. I think if we're going to continue having a world championship, there's no reason to just make it one of the majors. And frankly, a major that isn't even run as good as at least one of the other ones. So like, that's the other weird thing.
It is such a weird one, because when you look at the two sports that are the closest to disc golf and how they run their majors, and that being golf and tennis, right? Yeah. You look at tennis, and tennis has the French Open, got to be able to play on clay. They have Wimbledon, got to be able to play on grass. And then they have the US Open and the Australian hard Open, surface, which are both hard services. And the US Open, you're playing at Arthur Ashe Stadium. You're basically in New York, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you have all that added, like, American kind of media and stuff. So there's that. And then the Australian Open's kind of like, it's the Australian Open. That's probably like the one that's the smallest out of the four.
It is true. There's always one major that gets left behind.
When you look at disc golf,
the PGA, basically. The PGA.
Yeah, when you look at disc golf, and we can go through the PGA where you have Augusta. It's got, obviously, the rich history, and it's on that course. And you get the green jacket. You got the U.S. Open, which is basically always going to be the really hardest courses, playing with the hardest setups. And then you got the Open, where you have to play links-style golf, and you have to, most of the time, endure the elements, whether that be wind, cold, rain, whatever. So all three of those.
And then you got PGA.
And the PGA doesn't really know what they're doing. The problem is, like, I think what the PGA is and what the kind of Australian Open is what the World Championship is in disc golf, which it should be the exact opposite. Like, USDGC, it's at Winthrop. You know, like, the OB, the tough down the stretch, the history. That's cool. Champions Cup is brand new, so it's like, who knows? And then European Open, it's at the Beast over in European Open. You have to deal with going over, you know, you have that. So you have like those two are pretty set in stone. And then like the World Championship, it's like, yeah, we just play at different courses. The setup isn't any different. The field isn't any different. Like there isn't like a thing that really stands out like a Wimbledon or like a US Open or whatever. And it's like, this is now the biggest one. Like that should be the biggest one, should be the one that like stands alone, that there is no kind of question. So that's where I think it is kind of weird. I think there definitely are things they can do outside of just making it longer to making the World Championship. I think the biannual thing, because eventually down the road, I know people are going to hate this take, but it is true. Eventually down the road, if disc golf continues to go on the path it's going, and granted, we kind of did like a big here, you know, jump spike, and now we're just slowly growing. And I think it's just going to be a slow grow, and there's going to be a plateau. Disc golf, as much as you want to think it is not going to get bigger than golf. It won't. It was created. Same thing as like pickleball is not going to get bigger than tennis. It's just not going to happen in our lifetime, at least. And it won't get close to the hockeys or the soccers or the baseballs or anything like that. It could get up there to a pretty high like second tier sport, but it's never going to get this massive thing. But we still have so much growth to go to where I think like 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years from now, they're just kind of how like people do that with Climo with his world championships. I think you're going to see the same thing with the people that have won world championships in the 2010 to 2020 era, because you can't tell me right now in 5 years winning a world championship in 2025. Well, that's not 5 years, but in winning a world championship in 2025 is a completely different ball game than winning in 2015. Yeah. Completely different. Yeah. And so you're going to have this kind of thing of where how the world championship was viewed in the 2010s and the 2000s isn't what it's viewed like now. And so that's where I don't think we need to have necessarily like, okay, well, we've been always doing it this way. Like, I think this is the perfect time to experiment, to do it biannually, to do it every 2 years, to make it really special of where it's like, because I know some people are like, well, that's not fair. People, yada, yada, yada. I just think now's the time to do it. Because 50 years from now, you can set that precedent. You can set that history now and make something really, really special. I know that's probably a bad – I know probably a lot of people are going to be annoyed with that. But no, we're so much in the infancy now of disc golf of where you can get away with this kind of stuff, of like changing it up or trying.
People don't look at disc golf in the correct window. They think like, oh, we've arrived, right? Well, no, it's not true. Like, literally anybody with a bunch of money could come around tomorrow, create a brand new tour, and if they had enough resources, they could get every single player to move to their tour in a snap of a fingers. Like, there could be the PDGA could be completely overthrown
by some other entity. How did your rating update do, man? We didn't forgot. Silas, what's your rating update? We forgot to talk about rating updates.
I didn't get it. I haven't played a sanctioned event.
Oh, man.
Who knows what Silas' rating is?
Well, I don't have a PDGA thing.
What happened to the road to 900, Silas?
He's an unsanctioned bad boy.
I'm a rebel.
He's put that in your bio. That's funny.
No, but you're right. Like it would not be very hard for all of a sudden the PDGA just to be absolutely obsolete in the Pro Tour.
All you have to do, I mean, look at what just happened. It was happening to the PGA Tour right now. Like,
and they're so
and they've been around for hundreds of years. Like, it's not. Like, it is. It's hilarious to think that disc golf is just like settled in. You have to be willing to experiment. I think, like for instance, the Champions Cup. I think they did a great thing in creating a new major. Like, that was good. I think the Champions Cup, what they should do personally is they should be the wooded major. I think they
That's a sick idea.
I think they should play wooded courses, and they should have a – the other thing that they should do, and I think that Worlds should do something similar to this, is I think they should make a – and maybe even European Open should do something like this because there's a lot of good courses in Europe – is I think they need to establish a set of courses that
are like a rotation
that rotates. You know, oh, US Open's going back to Pebble Beach this year. You know, situations like that to where 20 years from now, no matter which course in the rotation you're at, there's familiarity, there's storylines associated with that course. There's certain players who have won at that course, that major. So I think that the Champions Cup should do that. I think they should, like, maybe Northwoods is a course they go to. Like, they should play wooded courses. That would be a cool, like, niche for them to have. The U.S. Open, I think there should be at least one major that has just its course. Right now, that's the USDGC. That won't be that way forever, but I think they're working on a replacement course for that. I don't know. But Worlds is so tricky because all it has is the title, and the title just carries so much weight in disc golf, and it's just like, how many years is it going to take for that weight to go down? Because, like, right now – and, like, it's funny. The funny thing, too, is you talk to a lot of disc golfers, even ones who haven't won world titles, and even these days they'll still say they would rather win a U.S. title just because of how difficult it is and the history with that event. Whereas, like, Worlds, other than the name world champion and, like, – getting a disc that has your name on it, like, there's just so many weird incentives that come with winning a world title that it's like disc golf just has built this structure around the world champion, and it's super odd. Now, I'll say with, like, with James Conrad, I think this was the first year that, like, maybe the world title lost a little bit of sting, and I think that the other thing about the world title that was so bolstered was the fact that you had, like, you know, you had four straight years of Paul winning. So you basically, not only was it a big title, but it was like the fan favorite at that time, just kept winning it. So that created, like, this atmosphere around Worlds. But then, like, oh, all of a sudden Greg Barsby wins. And, like, it kind of just, everybody just kind of, like, forgot about it a little bit. But then Ricky wins two in a row. And, like, everybody loves Rick. So, like, then it kind of gains momentum again. But, like, yeah, I just think it's just like this weird spot in disc golf. It's the only thing that feels like it's sticking around disc golf from the past that, like, just doesn't really have a place. And, like, as somebody who has watched disc golf for, like, the better part of a decade, like, I will still watch the World Championships this year, and it'll feel like a very big deal to me. But even in my mind, it's like the Christmas morning effect. Like, when you're young, like, Christmas is such a crazy event. Like, you're literally counting it down for months. And then as you get older, it slowly is like, oh, yeah, Christmas is here. That's great. But it's not quite the same effect. And, like, that's how I feel with Worlds, where, like, it's going to come up and I'm going to be, like, excited about it. But it's not going to have the same effect as it used to on me. Where, because, like, now every event with the Pro Tour feels so big. That Worlds doesn't feel big anymore.
There isn't as much of a drastic difference between, and this is coming from someone that, you know, that just obviously jumped into the sport. And I know, like, that was a big topic that me and Hunter talked about at my first World Championship. And I think 5 years ago, 10 years ago, sure, it probably did feel very different.
Yeah.
But where the Disc Golf Pro Tour has stepped up and has done a great job at a lot of these Elite Series events, it just feels like another Elite Series event.
Everything I just said about Worlds, if the PDGA, like, all it would take is for the PDGA to say, okay, this is going to be the largest purse in the sport, and it's not even close. We're going to have a $500,000 purse, and we're going to play at the most pristine course you've ever seen. It's going to be treated so much differently. There's going to be, you know, player areas with tents and parking and all this. If they were just to go all out on the event, then there you go. That would solve the problem. Then you would have an event that's unlike any other. But as the standard continues to rise from all the other ones that are making a ton of money because of sponsorships, that is not really possible anymore. The PDGA is slowly going to become such a small, and this is the effect already in, you know, in professional golf. You know, obviously the PGA Tour is where the money is, you know, not with the PGA of America. There's money there, but not the kind of money we're talking about. There's not television rights and that sort of thing. So what's going to happen is slowly the Pro Tour is going to get more money because that's where the marketing money and advertising is going, and the PDGA will get smaller. And now it's like, okay, why is the PDGA solely responsible for running this giant major that they don't really have the resources to put on an event that's even close to what the Pro Tour can do? So, like, that's where it gets even trickier.
It's more too, just like, you know, the how much allocated resources do they want to put into it, right?
Yeah.
And, like, that's the key is, like, if they do a good job, then sure, keep doing it. But I think we got to be okay with it. We got to be okay if people don't do a good job of being like, okay, we need to find a solution here.
Yeah, it's the thing with Worlds 2, it's so reliant on the host right now, because, like, this year it's going to be in Emporia, so it's going to be great.
It's going to be, it's going to be good.
Dynamic is going to, they're going to handle business because their reputation will be associated with the event, and so it'll probably be run really smoothly, and it'll be awesome. But, obviously, you had some debacles last year with the practice area situation, and, like, it's just so dependent right now on, like, who they essentially give Worlds to
versus having like a Worlds like committee.
Like, there needs to be a committee. Yeah.
Like that.
So, like,
make
that's
sure everything runs well. Yeah.
I don't know, man. You know how I feel about the PDGA. They sketch me out. I don't.
All right. Let's go wrap.
Yeah, okay. Quickly change the subject.
let's go. Well, I don't want any suspensions. I don't want anything. let's go quick rapid fire. And then Silas, you have some topics for us here at the end of the show. So quick rapid fire. These are going to be either, like, yes or no questions,
yes or, no.
Or, like, what's the or question? Either or.
This or that?
This or that, I guess, would be the good way of saying it. Okay. So, would you rather play in 30 degrees or 95 degrees?
Is there wind in the 30-degree situation? Are we going calm?
No, we're just going calm for both. Sunny and calm for both.
Sunny and calm for both. Hmm. 30 degrees when it's not windy is doable for me as long as I have a hand warmer. 95 sucks. I'd still say 95.
Okay. I'm going 95. Silas?
Yeah.
I'm going 95.
Yeah. And this is also taking out humidity too, because 95 humid.
Yeah. There's a big difference.
Yeah, no, if it was super humid, I'm taking 30.
We're doing like 80, high 80s right now in Illinois with humidity, and it's like we're playing in a sauna. It is. I was sweat. I mean, I had to buy this like Gold Bond stuff because my legs were just freaking chafing. Mm-hmm. Too much information. All right, should Circle One be shrunken? Should we shrink Circle One? Does Circle One need to be shrunken?
Shrunken? Like, make it smaller? Wait, what am I?
I think Silas wrote this one wrong.
No, it was saying, like, Circle One, should we get rid of Circle Two and just have one circle, or should we just add on? Should we make a Circle Three?
Circle One needs to be
bigger.
Bigger is the correct. Is the correct one.
Do we take away Circle Two?
Or to answer your question, no, it should not be shrunken. It should be. I think Circle One should be made bigger.
Yeah, yeah. So you can't like step putt like, or jump putt from 30 feet.
It should be
feet.
Like 55 feet or 60 feet or so.
Should we take away Circle Two then?
Well, Circle Two doesn't.
I think that's just like a really statistic. Exist. I think
it's
that's just like
statistic.
To see if you.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Which I think
that's
the putting fair. Statistics should all be.
But should
changed.
That be expanded?
Putting statistics are maybe the worst statistics we have.
Yeah, they should all be. Putting statistics should be like 0 to 10 feet, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, 30 to 40. That's how putting.
So there should
be
no Circle 2.
Well, Circle 2 is only used for statistics. Like,
yeah, so yeah, do we just take
it doesn't
that
need
out,
to
then?
Exist. I think the whole C1, C1X, C2 thing is dumb.
I think the circle
needs to exist.
I think Circle 2 is still good in the sense of seeing how someone threw. Like, it gives you a good gauge of...
Oh, Circle 2 and Reg is...
Yes.
Is a, yeah,
that's a
that
good,
makes
that's
sense.
A good stat because it's like...
I do,
realistically,
yeah,
that's,
I will
a,
say,
that's a birdie chance.
Yeah. The circles for regulation is a fine stat. It's just for putting, it's so misleading.
Putting, it's terrible. Okay. Regulation, I think it's a good stat.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Okay. This is one I think that me and – I think me and Silas debated against this one. Or it could have been Hunter.
Oh.
Would you – and I don't even remember what I even said, so I might disagree with my old take. Would you put Ronaldo and Tom Brady in the same fame tier?
Not even close.
I said no.
Ronaldo is 10 times the following, if not more.
You also do follow soccer.
I can't.
Nobody knows who Tom Brady is in Europe, Silas.
No, I'm just
I can't
trying
remember what
to
I
make
said.
A defense because I think Hunter.
Everybody, everybody, can't obviously, in the United States, I would give the slight edge to Tom Brady, perhaps.
In the U.S., yeah.
I don't know, though, because we have a very diverse population, so I'm not even willing to say that.
Well, you also have to take into account what is the definition of fame in this scenario. Is fame...
Right, how many people know your name? If you say, do you know who Tom Brady is?
Know
do you know who...
It's just do you know them. Of them?
Yeah, do you okay. know of them? And Ronaldo wins by...
So the most famous person is probably
Sai. People do not know about him.
Sai is probably the most famous person in the world.
As in the guy who did Gangnam Style?
Oh, I was like, what?
Well, I mean, it took a while for that name to click, so probably not.
Yeah.
I would say, like there is a shocking amount. Like, people outside the U.S. do not – like, we get so obsessed with American football
that big.
In our country.
It's not that big outside.
It's not very big. No. You go outside of this country, and people do not have a clue.
I think Tom Brady is high, though, because of – obviously, he is, like, probably the most talked about NFL player. But then also he's got Giselle, who I think she also – that whole situation I think made him even bigger. He has been in some movies and stuff like that. So I mean,
he's probably the most notable football name. But
worldwide.
I mean, it's not even close.
Yeah, worldwide.
Not even close. There is a shocking – like, you would be shocked that the soccer – like.
I wouldn't be shocked.
If there was a,
I wouldn't be shocked.
You would be shocked at how low tier of a soccer player you could find that actually has more notoriety than Tom.
I wouldn't be shocked.
It's probably pretty far down.
They take soccer very seriously in pretty much every place except for the United States.
Yeah.
Last one I got here, and then we'll jump to Silas. Okay. Would you rather be tall? I'm guessing this is more like in the scope of like disc golf. Would you rather be taller than me, so 6'6" and higher, or shorter than Hunter, so 5'10" or shorter?
Hunter's 5'10", so I'd be 5'9".
Is Hunter 5'10", not 5'11"?
I'm 5'11".
Oh, you got Hunter by an inch? Okay, so would you rather be...
It's close.
Would you rather be 5, let's just say 5'9" or shorter, or 6'6" and taller? In disc golf, if I was literally able to change your body type by height,
I would be 6'6". That's not even a question.
Okay. I'm not even quite.
I would be six.
I'm not even quite sure what the debate
six,
was
six.
On this.
I would be 6'6".
No, I think it was
Hunter was probably
Hunter,
saying
Hunter,
he'd rather
Hunter
be shorter.
Short. Hunter was saying shorter,
but like
I know this.
That's
because...
a ridiculous argument because you are 6'5". Me being 6'6" is not going to change between 6'5" and 6'6", and you are on the tour. So what's the question?
No, like, I think he was saying like hand
cool.
size. like that would be the too big of hand size to like grip the disc or something.
Yeah,
like
no.
That?
Here's how
no,
I approach that
Hunter
question.
Thinks hand. I think I might have been saying being too tall is a disadvantage.
I would agree.
I don't think is too tall. But I think if you're
six is 1 inch taller than so it's not too tall.
I think if you're 6'10", that could be an issue.
Yeah.
Like if you
change that question and you said, would you rather be 6'9" or 5'9", I would choose 5'9".
I think that's probably the right answer.
Once I get to that height, then I'm thinking, okay, that's going to be awkward to throw. But 6'6".
I think it's awkward to throw.
Is there anyone that's 6'9" on the tour?
No, I think Big Germ might be the tallest person at 6'6". He's 6'6".
Big Germ is like 6'6", and he's the tallest. And like he can play.
Yeah, he's fine. I think when you
– man's 37 years old.
I think when you start getting to that like 6'9", 6'10" height, you start – I'm not even thinking about how awkward of a swing it would be. I'm thinking about – all the times me being 6'5", where I'm like, gosh, I wish I was shorter. Because like there are times, obviously there are advantages being tall. I can reach
out.
Say,
how many times have you been able to straddle,
but
though?
Yeah, that definitely helps. But then there also are times where it's like, dang, this like limb is like right in my face. And it wouldn't even be in someone's way. So like there's advantages and disadvantages, obviously, being short, being tall. But I think when you get to that like tallness side, I think the advantages of being that tall like are not nearly as high as the disadvantages of like trying to be 6'10" and being in some of these like scramble spots off the rough. Like you're too huge, you're too big of a person, you're not gonna be able to get those
like
little crevices.
LeBron James Like, imagine watching LeBron crawl in there to, like, try and poke a forehand out. Like, it's not going to
happen. It's
going to
sound like he's, like, taking down the entire forest, just, like, getting into that spot.
Yeah.
All right, Sy, so you got a couple things for us? What do you got?
Yeah, I got a couple topics here from Twitter. First one is, if PGA players can't tee the ball up outside the tee box, PDGA players shouldn't be able to have a run-up outside of the tee box. What do you think?
Yeah, this is like the dumbest thing ever to me. I appreciate all of the people on Twitter that actually do stick
after
up
you
for
literally just told this person he's the dumbest person ever.
No, this argument, this way of arguing is dumb. Because, like, we do argue for a lot of things, and I understand, like, it's confusing. Because we argue for a lot of stuff to translate, but a lot of it is more business side and etiquette side, not necessarily rules.
Yeah. We do have the big rules one that we do is, like, we need to start using more hazards. Like, we need to have an OB stroke and distance.
Yeah, there are things. But, like, just saying, oh, because they can't tee it up, you can't run up, they're two
Correct.
Different sports. You're hitting a ball versus throwing a disc. So, like, you can't just compare apples to oranges and say
– Golf like, is all about – golf even, is all about – yeah,
why.
Like, the how your ball is on the ground is very important in golf. Disc golf is not at all.
It's not about how your shot lies. So, having a run-up is purely just to allow you to throw
Correct.
Further. Whereas – yeah, I mean, you can hit further off a tee sometimes or a lot of times, but it's really mostly about improving your lie. That's really why players are doing it. It's not for the few extra yards or spin or whatever. So I just think that, like, it's dangerous when you just start thinking, like, everything from golf needs to apply to disc golf. There are things that the sports are just different. I think that I've heard the run-up argument before. My opinion is I like the idea of using hazards where there can't be a run-up from. That's cool. Like, you can't ground your clubs. Like, that would be my translation. If you can't ground your club, you can't have a run-up. Like, that's more of the translation for me. But I think if we took away run-ups, we would lose a lot of cool shot opportunities going forward into
You'd have
par
to also
fives,
change
that
a lot
sort
of holes,
thing.
Because now it's like...
Yeah, courses would have to change.
They're already changing in the way... Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, I'm just not. I'm not a huge.
Well, I will say though, now that we're talking about it, because sand and tall grass are like two things that cause run-ups to be very, very difficult. And I think that those are cool things to have incorporated into courses to really make it advantageous to hit the fairway. What do you think about this though? Because one of my least favorite like course designs is where you just have a hole. Think of like I'll just describe a hole. Literally just think of like any sort of golf hole of where you're just playing down the golf hole, a straight golf hole, of where there's just nothing it's kind of boring, right? After playing toboggan, being on like a little bit of an elevated hillside drastically changes your run up, drastically changes your throw. So what are your thoughts on let's just say you have a wide open 800 foot par four and it's just a fairway straight down. So similar to like hole 14 at Toboggan, but you start like incorporating like little hills.
Oh, in the fairway.
You just have like a 10 foot hill. In the fairway, to where
they already exist.
What do you mean they already exist?
It's a little place called Dunipace Dunes.
Oh gosh, I'm talking more like
it used, doesn't exist anymore.
I'm talking more like small little humps and stuff. So essentially, instead of me just thinking like I'm just going to try to throw this as hard as I can and wherever I end up, fine. Now it's like I don't want to throw over 450 feet because if I throw over 450 feet, I might end up on this like little hill, and that's going to make my second shot much more difficult.
No, what I have found in disc golf course design is the best defenses for holes are typically things that they didn't even try to do, but just kind of ended up happening with the way the hole is laid out. Here's a perfect example. At Sandusky Park, the hole with the elevated basket, it's hole 6. The way that hole shapes out, there is a path on the – so there's a hillside on your right – and then there's a like a low path to the basket, straight to it, and then there's a creek on the left. You could effectively throw a putter shot directly at the basket. That's a little daunting because of the creek on the left, so a lot of people want to throw hyzers. Mm-hmm. But because of this hillside, it makes that hyzer tougher because now you're worried about, A, getting stuck up on the hill. You can't skip down and it catches it. Like, there's just this weird subtleties in the way the land is laid out that make throwing that 250-foot shot difficult. Another example was last night.
Hole two at Idlewild is a perfect example. The upshot on hole two at Idlewild. Like, that's a standard 250-foot upshot, 300-foot upshot. But because the way that same thing you're saying, that the way that hill is, you got OB right, water left, that upshot becomes very difficult.
The way, like, Falling Creek, the last hole with the lattice behind mm-hmm. it, you know what I'm talking about? So that hole has the ground kind of goes subtly up into a hump to where you can only kind of see the top half of the basket.
Cool.
And also there's a tree right off the tee that blocks the hyzer. So it makes getting the height on that shot very awkward. Mm-hmm. You either stall it out too high or you a lot of times leave it into the hump of the grass like 50 feet short. And like they didn't try to do that. They just thought, it's the kind of our last hole. But every time I think about a hole that really just plays difficult for me for like really subtle reasons, I'm like, that is a great defense of a disc golf hole that they didn't even try to do. It just kind of is.
Elevation
so I think that,
changes
like,
and stuff like that are huge, I think.
Elevation change is key.
And like you're talking
but
about,
I think
if we could,
just
if
like
you can move ground.
Slopes.
Yeah,
like
if
subtle
you can
slopes.
Move ground,
yeah.
that's going to be a game changer.
People get so tied up in the, like, what can we bring into a green? Giant wooden poles or bunkers or whatever to make this hole harder when it's just very subtle things like the sloping of the grounds. Like I think the most exciting upshot events, like events to have upshots in, are where you have golf green situations where there's a lot of like slopes and rollaway mm-hmm. opportunities to where people are having to control the angles of their upshots. And there's nothing to that. It's just the way the ground is sloped. Like, that is so easy to do. And, like, think about it. Like, that's how golf greens work. If you just look at a golf green from a drone shot, it just looks like a big green circle. But you stand on it, and you see all the little slopes and the false fronts and things like that.
Hole 17 at European Open, golf, another good hole.
Yeah.
With that slope.
Yeah.
If that was exactly. all flat, that hole would be so easy.
Right. So I think disc golf just needs to play with angles more and moving around ground. And I think that
we need
would...
tractors and we need like excavators.
Yeah.
And
well, for sure. But that would defend holes a lot better than just being like, oh, we need to have a pond here or else the hole has no defense. Like there are better ways to accomplish things.
All right. Next question, Saz.
All right. A lot of these are about pace of play, which we already mentioned, but there was an interesting one. So we talked a little bit about the duration of Worlds, but Worlds this year actually ends on a Saturday. Does that affect viewership and does that affect
money? I thought
they
changed that.
Did they?
I thought I heard someone just say that they changed that.
They changed USDGC this year to make it end
on
Sunday.
Oh, is that what
I'm
thinking of?
Maybe.
I was looking on their website and it states that it ends on the 3rd.
August 3rd, which is USDGC.
I believe they shifted USDGC because USDGC, they used to always end it on a Sunday or a Saturday so they could have like the spectator day afterwards, but they're like
September 3rd is what it has it ending on.
Is September 3rd a Saturday, Silas?
Yes.
Okay, so it is still a Saturday.
Sorry, I said August 3rd, September 3rd.
Yeah, this is
interesting. Oh, I wonder. I have an idea of why they did that.
What do you think?
Because was Worlds last year ending on Saturday?
Yes. Yes, it did. Because
it did end on Saturday?
I drove to the beach the next morning after it ended, and I was one day late to that vacation, and normally I would have left on Saturday.
So I have a new idea then. My initial idea was they have to pay for the Emporia Country Club. And my initial idea was renting it out on a Sunday is probably way more expensive than renting it out on a Saturday. And instead of
that can't be true.
What I'm saying is like, well, yeah, it's
well not having,
not having to do
a
Saturday and a Sunday is definitely cheaper.
Well, yeah, that's definitely cheaper.
Sunday's 100% more expensive than Saturday by at least a little bit. It has to be.
Why?
Sunday, people play golf way more on Sunday than they do on Saturday.
Oof. As somebody that worked at a golf course Sunday's for a
more,
lot of years, I'd have to disagree.
I think more people play golf on Sunday than Saturday. But I'm
I would say it's similar enough that most courses probably have the same rate for both.
That course
is what I'll
that
say.
Course
it's probably,
probably
I'm not going to say it's probably. Drastic.
But now I'm
drastic.
Starting to think if the PDGA is involved in both these ending on Saturday, now I'm starting to think they want Sunday to be a travel day for them. Is that a selfish?
I'm looking at last.
Is that
year
a selfish reasoning?
Last I mean, year it other... also ended on a Saturday. They want a travel day. What do you mean? So them to get back,
so they can work on Monday. If the event ended on Sunday, then they have to. I mean, it has to be a PDGA thing. There has to be some sort of reason.
I mean, I would, if I had to guess.
What other reason could there be?
If I had to guess, I would say it's probably the cost thing, renting the country club 2 days. Last year, though.
Last year, they finished at the Fort. That's a disc golf course. Hmm. That doesn't have any factor.
That's interesting.
How far back does Worlds go finishing on a Saturday? I guess is also
I don't know, Silas, look up 2020 Worlds, see when it finished. Because
where was 2020 Worlds was at? Where was that at?
2020 Worlds won wait a second. Was there Worlds in 2020?
There was not Worlds in 2020.
No, yeah, you gotta look
so
at 2019.
Was that Blue Lake? No. The heck? Why am I trying to
Paul
act like
won.
I knew?
It was at Ledgestone. It was in Illinois.
Yeah, it was at
okay,
Illinois.
So that's a good one. That's a good one then, because both those courses aren't golf courses.
August 17th.
So you gotta look up what day that is, not what day that is this year. What day
right.
that is 2019.
Saturday. Go to 2018.
There's some conspiracy here. There's got to be some sort of reason. Like
it's probably so stupid of a reason, though. It's probably not even that deep.
That's what I'm saying. I think it has to be with the people run. Like it has to be some PDGA 9th
of September,
thing.
Yeah.
2018. This is as far back as we need to go to know if there's.
Yeah,
bet.
if it's the last four,
just go with it. September 19th. The days a week. Come on. Let's ask Google. Oh,
Sunday.
It was a Sunday.
It was a Sunday.
So they started it in 2019.
We gotta find this answer. There's got to be some like they new management. Like some new person came into the PDGA in 2019 and was like, guys, I've got family obligations. I got to get back to on Monday.
I don't know.
We can't be finishing this up on Sunday. This is taking away my Mondays. There's got to be something. There's got to be because there is no other logical reason to finish the event on Saturday other than
it's incredibly stupid from a spectator and viewership standpoint to not have a major cover both days of the weekend. Like that's. Pretty much the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Why would you do that?
You basically are taking away one day of viewership. Like one.
Yeah. Nobody can sit down at work on Friday and watch the golf. And then also people can't show up to Worlds. They got work. Like that's dumb. I don't know why
they
do
that. What are they doing on Sunday in Emporia?
Dude, something's going down Sunday in Emporia.
should the foundation, should we hold some crazy event on Sunday?
The real final round.
Oh, wait, is that why there's. Wait, I think that – hold on. I think that might be why.
Is there actually something
I think
going on?
They do stuff on Sunday. Size, how can
well,
we look
what,
that up?
That's how US – you got to look up like this event schedule for
yeah,
Worlds.
Size, look up the events.
That's
I think
how
they
it
do
was.
Stuff on Sunday for like AMs. I think that's why. I think there's like weird
that's how
stuff
it was for
USDGC
for years, but then they just decided to change it this year, I think.
Well, they probably realize, like, oh, this is probably not
we shouldn't cater to the AMs when it's like a bigger deal.
We can just have two really big sport spectator back to back days.
Saz, you got to go to 2022, my guy.
Yeah, I think that's what.
Where
it is.
Are you doing? Are you looking at last year's? This is still valid.
Yeah.
Is there anything? Does it say anything for Sunday?
Sunday.
No, it would be final round Saturday, Sunday. There's an arrow. Oh, it's pointing to field event. Is it? Wait, just scroll down. Scroll down to on there. Sunday, June 20th. Okay, no, keep going. That's the final round.
They don't even
have it listed. They don't even have it listed on like
nothing.
The event schedule.
There was nothing on Sunday.
There was nothing on Sunday last year.
Go to
this year's event and see if they have a schedule yet.
I feel like there's something on Sunday here, guys.
Last year there was nothing.
Last year there was nothing.
Yeah, go there. Event website.
No, there's nothing. Oh wait, what the heck?
Event schedule on the right.
What year is this?
All the way on the right.
Oh,
up
this is
there.
Masters.
Why? Here we go. Okay, Sunday. Go. Saturday, Sunday. They just have the pro shop hours
just
for Dynamic Discs. There's nothing.
Dynamic.
Nothing scheduled.
Nothing.
Dude, okay, what is going on, man?
We got to figure this out. Hopefully, someone listening knows why this is happening. Because we can all agree that having the event finish on Saturday and not capitalizing on 2 days,
it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. So we need someone to make this make sense for
bring
us.
Back Sundays. What is going on with that? That is so weird.
I could have swore they had events going on, but now
they're
I'm not
listed
sure.
on the event schedule.
Yeah. All right, Saz, give us one more, and we'll wrap this episode up.
All right. Yeah. We got one from Micah here. He says, how fast do you think big throwers like AB, David Wiggins, Drew Gibson, and them would throw a baseball? Similar disc speeds, or what do y'all think?
It just depends on their mechanics because
they definitely
have strong arms. Like there are people that are just born with strong arms, and like Anthony Barella is a good example. Like he's lanky, he's not in crazy shape. And his arm just moves fast. Like, he just rips the disc. If AB had a baseball background, he probably would throw really hard. However, he doesn't, probably, because he's been playing disc golf for a long time. Because if you have bad baseball throwing mechanics, you're not going to get a lot of velocity on it. I will also say that if you have a long baseball career before disc golf, it probably just hurt you. I mean, that's how it was for me. Like, my arm just got damaged throughout my baseball life. Mm-hmm.
I can't throw overhands anymore. Like, that used to be a throw that I could throw an Ultra Star like 150, sometimes maybe close to 200 feet overhand, like hammers.
Yeah.
And like that could be really useful in disc golf because, I mean, heck, you could 200 feet.
Overhands are great.
Yeah, you could probably go like – I could probably throw like 400 feet with like a driver or something, I'm assuming.
There's like, guys that can get them out there.
But like this motion now is like – this is gone.
Like I would, that,
any over-the-top motion, my shoulder is gone.
If a guy like AB could – like let's say he had great mechanics. I don't know like the exact translation. Well, here's an idea. Okay,
he
here's an idea.
He should be able to throw over 90 with his body frame.
Let's try and figure it out because like I could throw a disc – I believe 60 miles an hour. Does that sound right to you, Rody?
Yeah, you're probably in the low 60s.
Okay, I think 62. I think 62 is like the fastest I've thrown a disc.
I would put you probably around like 62, 63. That's
okay, and
right.
I have thrown a baseball at its fastest, I believe, like 74. So with that math, if AB can get a disc out there close to 80 miles an hour.
I think especially it gets higher as you go up.
Yeah.
I think the gap gets higher.
He might be able to get close to. I would think
because like someone lower. That's throwing like 40 miles per hour max, they're not going to be throwing 60 mile per hour baseballs.
Yeah, I don't know. This math is not. I'm just trying to give the people an idea, but I would guess like AB with good baseball mechanics.
I think he can get close to 90.
He could probably get close. I don't know if he could touch 90. I have no idea. Guys that can throw 90 miles an hour in baseball are pretty rare. Like they don't just like obviously at the pro scene you see them all over the place, but like. If you're throwing 90 and you have solid mechanics at all, you can go D1 pretty easily.
Here's another question.
It's pretty rare.
Do you think people, and we can kind of relate this to disc golf a little bit, but do you think people are born with punching power? That's something that's gets thrown around a lot in boxing and MMA, of where some people, no matter, like, obviously technique and all that stuff matters, and you can get better and stronger and stuff. But, like, they talk about how some people are just born with KO power. They can literally knock you out.
Fast twitch muscles, there are ways to, like, somewhat train them while you're still developing, but, like, at a very young age. But people are just born with muscle. Like, there are just some people that can get their hand from point A to point B quicker than others. And that is just how they are born. They have fast twitch muscles that work quicker. That is why you have guys – people will talk all the time – about the different builds in disc golf, and like he's tall and lanky, that's why he throws far. Well, yeah, it's part of it, but he also just has really good fast twitch muscles, and that's why he throws far. Like, it's everybody's always like looking to find like what's the ideal build for disc golf and this and that. Well, just take one good look at baseball pitchers and you understand that some people just have stronger arms. Like, it's just how it works. I played baseball with kids who were absolutely jacked, and then kids who were super lanky, and they threw that baseball at wildly different speeds, the lanky kid throwing it harder, because they just have the arm speed. It's just a thing that people have, and it sucks. Like, I mean, and it's not even, like, genetic. Like, my dad, he pitched in college, and he threw, like, low 90s, and I could only throw low 70s. Like, it's very random. And that's just kind of how it is.
What do you think the average height?
I'm not bitter about it or anything.
What do you think the average height of MLB pitchers are?
You do see a correlation to height in some extent, not necessarily because of velocity, but because the taller you are as a pitcher, the closer to home plate you're releasing the baseball. Which means that there's like a saying in baseball where like you have a really tall guy and they'll say, oh, you're practically handing it to the catcher because you're getting so far off the front of the mound that that ball is now getting out of your hand even
that
later.
Extra,
you have
like,
less time.
Foot or whatever it may be.
It adds up ridiculous. I mean, the numbers with baseball with how little time you had to react, you add just a few inches and it's monumental. So, I mean, I'll look it up right now.
It's 6'3".
Pitcher height.
I looked it up. It's 6'3".
Oh, okay. 6'3". So it's not – there's definitely a correlation there. Yeah.
It's not as correlated, though, as some may think.
Right. The problem is once you get to
the – 6'6" pitching.
Right. And the problem is once you get to the majors, all of those guys throw hard at that level. So having just a little bit of extra height, that's just the additional thing that gets you a little further.
Advantage. Yeah.
So, like, that's the thing. There are guys that are – but there are pitchers that are 5'9" that throw 96.
We need to do like a batting cage video. I would love to do it. Like batting,
see how fast we can hit.
Going to the batting cages is so fun. I've never the most humbled.
Just turn it up.
The most humbled I've ever been in any sort of athletics.
Hitting off batting cages is tough.
Yeah. Besides trying to learn the butterfly and swimming, second to that, the most humbled I've ever been was I used to date a softball player. And we went to the batting cages, and she was just hitting dingers.
Yeah.
And I had never played – every sport, I think you're better off – if you're trying to hit a softball pitch, you're better off without any –
not having
– like – yeah. Without any, like, racket, club, swinging sport. You're better off just being fresh and coming in, I think, than having that because – everything I did was low to high. Like, everything I did was low to high, low to high. And in softball, low to high.
It's a chop.
Yeah. Yeah. You get crushed. And so, like, I was like, I think I, like, whiffed the first, like, 10. And I think the best I ever got, I think I got, like, contact 2. Like, I contacted 2 of them, like, foul tipped 2 of them out of 20. And it wasn't even, like, super fast. Like, we're talking, like, still only, like, 70, 65, something in that range. But just the way the ball lifted, I just could not. I could not figure it out.
I've never really tried to hit softball pitching, but I mean, I've seen guys just get dumbfounded by it because A, they're closer to the home plate, and B, they're just throwing a pitch that moves away that you're not used to.
It's like wiffle
hitting off a batting.
It's like those wiffle ball videos in TikTok, where they're just like striking the crap out of the baseball guys. Because the ball's like coming at their head and it like dives in.
Yeah, it's just a different type of thing to look for. I mean, because like, and hitting out of batting cages is tough because it's really hard to time. Some are better than others at like showing you when the ball is going to release. But like, because I saw 90 miles an hour a couple times in high school, and you can deal with it. Like it's doable when you're watching a guy throw it at you. But when you see like, once you get towards 80 miles an hour in a batting cage and it's just dropping on you real quick, it feels like 150 miles an hour. Quick. I remember the first time I saw, I think I was in high school. And at that time I was seeing pitching where guys, like if guys were throwing 80, it was hard, but like 70s was normal. And I saw 75 in a batting cage and expected it to be like pretty easy. And I just, the first one just blew past me. And I was like,
no time
what
to
the
react.
Heck was that? I was like, is that 70? Like, it's just so weird watching it shoot out of a machine. Yeah. You hear that little thump and like, yeah, it'll get you. You got to really be ready.
Have you seen that big guy that swears like he's the best hitter?
He gets like 5 feet away from the machine, just fouls them off.
Like always contacting. Gosh. That guy was, I don't know what happened to that guy.
I have made contact on 99.3% of every single ball pitch. Like you find somebody else that can do that.
Oh, I love that guy. All right. Well, good episode. Solid episode. We got to get a way of, I don't know, maybe it is like a world's thing where like once a month, like a very rare occasion, once a month, I jump on the banter. We do like a Skype me in on the banter or something, because I do feel like we are missing a little bit of the discussions with Hunter when he has these takes. And it feels like I just can't. I'm watching, I'm listening, and I can't. I have nothing.
Well,
I miss.
Like a few weeks ago, or like a week ago, Hunter decided that he's not going to argue anymore. He said he's the new Hunter now. And so we're going to have to try and get him back out of his shell. He got tired of the comments going after him, and he was like, I'm not going to argue anymore on the banter. So we haven't had a banter with him since he made that. Or no, we have one. And we didn't argue at all. But we've seen like his shell crack a few times, because like he's been walking around the office like with that mentality, like I'm not going to.
Well,
get
he does
an
have
argument,
a newborn,
like,
so I do feel like the energy, like obviously he's trying to keep it positive and stuff, which I respect.
No, but we'll crack his shell for sure. We just got to bring up something that like we know we're wrong about.
That is true.
And then he'll
just
get going.
Dig it underneath his skin.
Just take one for the team. We'll just argue something.
Also,
stupid.
Like. I think once basketball season starts getting close for college, I think he starts getting more on edge.
Well, but the problem is when he argues for Duke, like he argues and he knows sometimes that he's just like being silly, like just saying things just because he wants to make us mad. But if we argued something that he fundamentally has a belief about, and I'm willing to like you and I pick something and go into it like fully committed to arguing the other side of it, even though if we know we're wrong – then we can get
like
him. Because then he'll have to say something.
We might have to do the one where we both decide that actually after thinking about it and cranking the numbers, the first person should always lay up the putt in doubles. That might get him going.
Oh, I don't even know if I could do that. He would look at me with such betrayal. Oh my gosh. That would be
Are you guys done with Bowie Bro battles?
Like
no, just for the season, for this year. You guys still have?
No, we have locations kind of planned out, but we still have one for every – we're going to do one for every month.
Oh, I just didn't know if you're filming more, if you had more to film.
We are. We are probably still going to – well, we are definitely going to Pennsylvania and probably Massachusetts, and then at the latter part of the year, probably Florida when it gets cold.
Florida will be a good one.
There's potentially like 1 month where we were planning on maybe going to Idlewild, but then that we could still change that around maybe. But there's definitely still something that need to be filmed.
Sweet. Sias, you got anything else for us?
I think that's going to wrap it up.
Hopefully the audio is much better for this one, guys. Thank you for Trevor for filling in. I guess we didn't even really mention why Hunter wasn't on this one. So if you're still listening, Hunter did shout out to him and Lizzie He is now the second in the Foundation crew of having a newborn. Who's next? Yeah. That's a good one. Any wagers? Silas, any wagers? Is it you? Are you the next baby dad?
No, it's not. No, it's not me. I'll tell you that for free.
Hey, man. All I'll say to you on that matter is picture me my last year of college, a single man. And then picture me 3 years later.
It happens quick, Silas.
Married with a child. It happens very fast.
So, yeah, let us know if you guys are listening to this Apple Podcast or whatever. Jump over on the YouTube and let us know in the comments. Give us the odds of all the Foundation guys on who's going to have the next newborn. That would be a good one to see how it all breaks all down. Right. But thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it, and we'll see you in the next one.
Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.